Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 148 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling The Profession That Found WSU's Tim Murray 2. The Department of Plant Pathology is not as high profile as the Department of Crop and Soils at WSU, but I'd argue it's no less necessary for ensuring farmers continue to maintain their head start over the rest of the world in agricultural research. And yet, there have been three retirements recently within the department and a reassignment. Not to mention, now that he's chairman, Murray will have less time to devote to his extension appointment. I ask Murray, at what level of importance does the university place the plant pathology department, and what the department looks like today compared to 20 years ago?
Today, our department is smaller than it was 20 years ago. When I finished my first term as department chair in 2008, we had around 20 state faculty in the Department of Plant Pathology. And at the end of this year, we'll have 12.
Whoa.
Now, that said, departments of plant pathology across the country in general are smaller today than they were 20 years ago. That's been the nature, that's been the trend. How does WSU treat us? I think in this current hiring plan, we are in the process of filling a potato pathology position now, which is one of the retirements that happened last year. We interviewed candidates 3 weeks ago, and we're getting ready to talk to our top candidate now. We have permission to pursue three other positions over the next year. So plant pathology got more positions than any other department in the college in the current 2020 hiring plan.
Oh, that's good.
So, yeah, and I've talked, you know, the dean and I have talked about it, and I think he's committed to refilling positions as best he can, depending on what happens going forward with the hiring plan. We'll see what happens this next spring.
So a few months ago, I did a podcast with Jim Cook, and mm-hmm. Jim is a plant pathologist with the Agricultural Research Service, and he was known for his work on the Green Bridge. And of course, he swears that his field work was very important to what he did.
Right.
But today's plant pathologists, do they really need to do the field work? I mean, couldn't you just do everything required of you in a lab, what with cloning genes and sequencing genomes, etc.?
I think the short answer is no. I just planted my 41st set of field plots this last month. And for those of us who do translational research, the ultimate test is in the field. You can do a lot of different things in the lab, and the lab is indispensable to what we do today. But at the end of the day, you need to try it out in the field to see if it's going to work. You know, we joke sometimes that the we have this beautiful hypothesis that was ruined by cold hard facts. And that's what the field is. It's the cold hard facts of what we do. And when you do things in the greenhouse, you have a certain level of confidence in what's going to happen. You do things in the lab, you have a certain level of confidence. When you get to the field, that's the real test. Okay, mm-hmm. Is it going to work? And then even things that we can make work in the field may not be commercially viable. You know, I actually heard the podcast that you did with Jim, and he talks for years about using soil fumigation as a tool. We have lots of tools that we use in the field that provide us with, there are controls. They give us a idea of what might be possible or what might happen, but it never be commercially feasible. And so, yeah, the field is absolutely critical. Now, that said, there are plant pathologists who spend their career working in the lab, working on very basic all kinds of information. At the end of the day, though, that information needs to be translated into something that can be done in the field if it's going to help improve agriculture.
Very early on in my career as an agricultural reporter, I was at a WSU field day, and you know, a student showed a teaspoon of soil and said there were something like 5 million different microorganisms living in this little teaspoon of soil.
Right.
Now, I've forgotten a lot of information over my career, but that student's statement was etched on my memory. And can you speak for a moment to the number and diversity of soil microbiology and talk a little about the good, bad, and the ugly?
Well, that's an interesting fact, and things certainly have changed. So I guess the one thing I'll say is that student was probably underestimating what was in that gram of soil. Depending on what numbers you look at, if you look at the bacteria alone, if you just look at the total number of bacteria that are in a gram of soil, it might be on the order of 10 billion cells in that gram of soil. In terms of the diversity of what's there, you know, there's tremendous diversity there. You know, I started my career working more in soil microbiology and then kind of got into disease resistance, and now we're kind of going back to soil microbiology. But we knew 35 years ago that when we could only culture at most 5% of whatever was in the soil. And so 95% of what was there was a black box. And so we've always known that. We just didn't have a good way of quantifying what was there. And so that we have entered a new age of soil microbiology. It's actually a very exciting time because we now have the tools to see what is there. And so you hear a lot of talk today about the soil microbiome and metagenomic kind of studies, because that are trying to figure out what's there and what changes under different kinds of conditions. And
evolutionarily speaking, you know, everything is supposed to make sense. And why do you think that we need such a diversity of soil microorganisms?
Well, that's a great question. The soil is a huge, complex network, this system that takes place in soil. And I think when you talk to people who do this kind of work, what we hear more and more, it's not so much who's there as much as what they're doing. And so what is their function in the soil? Different groups of organisms are able to do different things and provide different services in the soil. And, you know, one example that comes to mind, it's not exactly on this topic, but you think for years you heard about finding microorganisms that could be or plants that could be added to mine reclamation sites because they were able to detoxify the materials that were in that soil. And I think that's an example of how there's a wide range of different functions that microorganisms play in the soil. And they are fairly simple organisms, so they have maybe one or two important things, really important functions that they fill, but collectively they're able to make this whole system function.
Okay, let's bring the discussion down from 35,000 feet to a farmer's field north of Highway 2. Now, snow mold is a problem that you've been working on, and it hasn't been completely solved. At the same time, I don't hear a lot of grousing about it anymore. Just explain how snow mold occurs and how we have mostly surmounted its impact.
Right. So snow mold, when we talk about snow mold, we're actually talking about a group of diseases that occur when wheat is under snow for some period of time. And depending on where you are and how long the snow cover lasts, will dictate which organisms you find growing on wheat underneath that snow. in Washington State, because most of the time when the snow falls, the soil is not frozen or it's not frozen completely solid, we have a particular group of organisms. And there's two in particular that we hear about. One is speckled snow mold and the other is pink snow mold. In Washington State, those are our two main problems. If you were to go north into Canada, you would find a different group of fungi that cause snow mold there. And other parts of the world, there are still other fungi. So when we talk about snow mold, it's kind of a generic catch-all. But in Washington State, for the speckled snow mold, historically, that's been our bigger problem of the two. We need to have about 100 days of snow cover on unfrozen soil before that disease will become really damaging. It may develop to some extent. And then as the snow cover persists past 100 days, then the damage potential increases more. And so in Washington State, about the maximum we see is about 150 days under snow cover. And so that's what favors the disease. Pink snow mold, that pathogen, that fungus is more widespread, and it doesn't require as much snow cover. The duration, about 60 days for it to be a problem. It can be quite damaging when it occurs, but for whatever reason in our northern wheat growing area, it's been more of the speckled snow mold that's the problem.
And it doesn't seem like it is much of a problem. Is that the fact that we don't have 100
right.
days of snow, or is it the fact that we have resistant varieties?
It's really the latter. We have resistant varieties that are doing a pretty good job of controlling the disease now. In fact, even with climate change, we've seen snow mold in our plots up in Douglas County the last 3 years in some locations. Not all locations, but in some locations, we've seen the disease. So we are getting the snow cover, but by and large, we have varieties that have pretty good resistance available. The challenge is that the nature of this resistance is very different from resistance that we think about with other diseases. Stripe rust, eye spot, those kinds of things. For the most part, you have the genes in the plant, and the plants are resistant. With snow mold, it's not just one gene. It's not just one gene that has a really large effect. It's a lot of small genes added together that make the plant resistant. And then it takes some environmental conditioning for the plant to become resistant, what we call cold hardening. And so the plant needs to be exposed to cold temperatures, for about 6 weeks for that resistance to develop. It's probably associated with the normal cold hardening process that occurs with winter wheat plants as they prepare to withstand cold temperatures during winter. There's physiological changes that occur, and with the snow molds, we know in particular, there's a group of polysaccharides, basically sugars, called fructans that are associated with resistance, so that these fructans accumulate to a higher concentration, and they're metabolized more slowly over winter in resistant plants than in susceptible plants. So it's very different than what we usually think about with resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Other types of disease resistance.
And so where are we with the problem now? Is this something that we need to continue to research, or is this something that, you know, hey, we basically solved it?
Well, I think this problem is like a lot of wheat breeding problems, as it's an ongoing process. You know, we've got varieties that have really great yield potential. Why don't we just stop now? You know, just use the varieties that we've got now. Well, the thing is, we're always making these incremental gains. If we'd said that 30 years ago when we were still growing new gains and wheats like that, we wouldn't be where we are today. And that's the nature of, I think, what we do in developing varieties that are gonna perform. One of the challenges with snow mold is, because it is a complex trait, it's not as easy to breed for and maintain that that resistance. And so the breeders need to continually, as they're making their crosses and making their selections and so forth, and as we said earlier, get it out into the field for the final test to make sure that it's effective. You know, as time goes on, we are getting better with molecular tools where we have molecular markers, and this is part of the research that we've been doing, is trying to figure out, okay, which genes are going to be the best, the most effective, and can we find markers for those to help manipulate them, move them around easier and with greater certainty, so that when we get to the field, we have a pretty good chance of knowing that we've got those resistance genes in there and the ones that we want in there.
Okay. So here's another difficult to define challenge, and that's declining soil pH.
Yep.
And you indicated that soil microbiology was something that you started your career doing.
Right.
I'm wondering, do different diseases occur under different levels of soil pH? And what diseases are we talking about when soil pH levels go too low?
Well, that's an interesting question, because when I said I worked on soil microbiology, I spent about the first 15 years of my career working on soil pH, low soil pH, and the impact that it had on specifically on cephalosporium stripe. Of the wheat diseases that occur in the Pacific Northwest, cephalosporium stripe reacts more strongly to acid soils than any other disease. There are some other diseases that have some response to the acid soils, but not like cephalosporium stripe. And this all really came to light right about the time that I was starting here. My predecessor, Bill Breel, had a graduate student who was working on this problem. And he had followed up on a report that came out of Kansas State where cephalosporium stripe, they showed that cephalosporium stripe was more severe with acid soils. And so he wanted to follow that up here, and that's basically what Connie Love's thesis was, to demonstrate that, in fact, that happened. And so when we saw the dramatic response that occurred, and knowing about that time, this was like 1982, 83, right in there, Bob Mahler had published a paper, Bob Mahler from the University of Idaho, had published a paper that really kind of sounded the alarm for soil pH in my mind. He had taken the previous 30 years worth of soil test data from soil labs and demonstrated that the pH in some areas had dropped significantly. And they followed that up with some more work showing that there were some critical pH levels below which there was a real drop-off in productivity. And he did that not only for wheat, but some of the other rotation crops grown in the area. And so we were interested in trying to get at what was going on and what was causing this. And we came up with a lot of partial explanations, but not an explanation in my mind that was really completely satisfying in terms of saying this is what we know is happening. What we did demonstrate, though, was that if you raise soil pH above about 5.5 with liming, that you could significantly reduce cephalosporium stripe problem. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how we got our start, and I've returned, kind of come full circle in my career now. We're 30 years down the road from when we became aware of this problem, and we still are not doing significant liming in eastern Washington for a couple of different reasons. But soil pH has continued to go down, and we now have aluminum toxicity being a regular topic of discussion in some parts of our production area.
But we also have breeders here at WSU who are breeding resistance to
right.
aluminum toxicity. Isn't that the way to go rather than having to lime your fields?
Well, I have a graduate student working on this problem right now, and we have soil. She just set up a study a week ago with soil from the field where the breeders are working. And, I talk with Aaron Carter about this, and he says, my definition of success for that aluminum toxicity plot is if I get a plant that produces one head. And this is a problem that breeding will contribute to, but it won't solve by itself. And I say that because no matter how good we can make the wheat plant tolerate the acid soil or the aluminum in that acid soil, just doing that is not going to change the other problems that occur in acid soils relative to fertility. When you get these really strongly acid soils, things like nitrogen and phosphorus become less available, even though you might be putting a lot on the soil. The plant can't get it. Other nutrients become toxic, become less available. And so this is a problem that we're not just going to breed our way out of. We need to have a more holistic kind of a solution for it. And I think that solution is going to involve applying lime or something like it that's going to raise the pH back up into a more desirable range.
Well, okay, so that begs the question. Let me explain. I had a soil scientist tell me, he's from Canada, that other people in North America lime their soils like they put on their underwear every morning.
Right.
And why isn't liming used here very much? And are there other more cost-effective alternatives?
Yeah, I think the short answer to why liming is not done here is because historically we have not had really accessible source of limestone. And so it's expensive. And we've been blessed with soils that are very fertile, and so we've enjoyed that. But as we've applied nitrogen to increase productivity, we've also added the acid that's going to reduce the soil pH. So historically, we haven't done it. We don't have a history of doing it. Some growers are applying lime to raise pH because they realize that they've got a problem. And we have a lot of variation in our soils and in soil pH. And so some growers haven't reached that critical threshold yet. Others have. But the future, I think, is going to involve liming. Limestone is a very effective agent, but, you know, depending on the soil, it may take a couple of tons per acre. Can we identify ways to maybe reduce that amount to target where we put the lime at planting time, for example, to help offset this? You know, I think these are questions people are asking and looking at. There's several people working on liming. We're taking a look at some alternative products. We're working with Inland Empire Paper because they have this waste product, fly ash, which they produce, you know, a lot, and mostly it goes to the landfill, but it has high lime value. You know, could that, something like that, be used to help offset this at a lower cost, say, than limestone? There are sources of limestone around. People are using it. I think it's only a matter of time. Some of the pHs that we're looking at today are scary low. And then when the soil up in Rockford that we're working with, over 200 parts per million aluminum. These are really, really difficult conditions for a wheat plant.
Is Rockford the canary in the coal mine when it comes to low soil pH? Certainly that region is facing some of the worst pH consequences, but that may also be a function of the soils and the rotations used. Among all the challenges facing wheat farmers, low soil pH is probably not in the top three. But there's no doubt farmers are losing bushels to the problem. I hope you enjoyed my two-part episode with Tim Murray, chairman for the second time of the Department of Plant Pathology at WSU. Please join me here again next week for Wheat All About It!
We're all children of a special treat. A miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread. A crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior.
lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.